Accession number 13271, Reel 4.
And of course there were special forces put ashore on the mainland, as well as the Falklands. They got, as far as I recall, very little information from the mainland. When they tried to have a guy on the end of the runway to be able to say when aircraft were getting airborne, and to a certain extent it worked, but it was very hit and miss. And obviously, the special forces did a very good job in the Falklands themselves in terms of sorting out the actual positions of the Argentines and being able to provide information for the main assault. The one sadness was, the tragedy was Bluff Cove, where we did not have enough information. The weather was bad, and of course they were bounced by Mirage. With the awful massacre that took place there of Welsh Guards. And the weather was a real problem because it was bad and it was going into midwinter. And so that was a great difficulty. So we were always strained to the utmost, and there was this terrible fear of Exocet. We did not have the defences for Exocet. It was a very potent system. Very dashing pilots, good aircraft against carrying them. And I think we were lucky. There were several Exocets that just didn't lock on, went into the sea or missed, but were fired against capital ships. It was a very close-run thing. But we got away with it.
Were there lessons in this, though, you know, bearing in mind from what you've been saying earlier, that everything was geared towards the Soviet threat?
Yes. Yes, I think the bottom line for me was, how was it that we got sucked into a conflict with an erstwhile friend, historically, who we'd sold all these arms to, are now being used against us? I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that you know, the major casualties to our own forces were caused by the Exocet system. You know, that this whole business of the arms trade, it's an enormous own goal and so unnecessary. It really began to make me think, once I'd left the Navy, about all this. And I suppose, yes, I'm jumping ahead really to something that happened the beginning of the Gulf War for me, but if I may just recount something that concerned the Falklands. I went to see Colonel Chris Keeble of Two Para, who had come out of the army about three or four years after the Falklands, but I went to see him at the beginning of the Gulf War because I was so concerned about the ground offensive and what was going to happen, and I didn't know enough about ground troop actions and the threat. And I had seen an interview he had done in the paper about his own experience at Goose Green, and it interested me, and I went to see him at his home, and it was a most amazing experience. First of all, I didn't know even what he looked like before, but when he opened the door, there was this great, tall, handsome Apollo man, although his hair had gone white, and he's only my age. I mean, a real sort of St. George incarnate. And then he spoke, and I expected the sort of army bark, but in fact he spoke softly. And he invited me in, and he asked me what I wanted, and I said, well, first of all, you should know that I was the staff officer intelligence who was meant to be providing you with intelligence support when you were pinned down at Goose Green and clearly so very nearly went wrong. I wanted to just let you know the problems we had, and then I wanted to hear what happened, because I've heard this rumour about what actually happened at Goose Green. And he went ahead and told me, and roughly what happened was this, and I don't think this has been made public. As you probably recall, his commanding officer, Colonel H. Jones, had tried to lead them in a sort of desperate breakout from their pinned down position. They'd been fighting for something like 40 hours, and then they were pinned down by a very much superior force. They'd had no air support because of the bad weather, and they were running out of ammunition. They'd lost a lot of men, and he tried this breakout in desperation, and he was immediately mown down. And so Chris Keeble, as second in command, was left with this situation. And he said that he's a devout Catholic, and he decided that he was going to pray. And he went away on his own, and he said he carried with him a prayer, always, sealed in one of these plastic covers. And the prayer is, I think, the one attributed to Henry the VI, the young king who built King's College, Cambridge. Chapel, King's College Chapel, Cambridge. And it is something like, Lord, I am the instrument of thy will, do with me as thou wilt. And he said, he read this out to himself, and from feeling exhausted, cold, not knowing what to do, he suddenly felt warm and calm, and he knew what to do. He went back to his NCOs and his young officers and said, we're going to negotiate. And he had two prisoners, Argentine young officers. One of them spoke English. He had them brought to him, and he said to them something like this. He said, you have seen how we fight. We have seen how you fight. We both respect each other as warriors, but you are never going to win because you are in the wrong. I believe there is no sense in prolonging this battle. I am therefore going to send you back through the lines with a message for your commanding officer that if he sends an officer with a white flag to a certain rock tomorrow at dawn, we will lay down our arms and come out. And he did that. And he said he slept for the first time with H. Jones' body lying alongside him. Following morning at dawn, there was the Argentine officer on the rock with the white flag. They laid down their arms and came out. And they discovered that the Argentines had four times as many troops as them, and they had the ammunition. But they decided that enough was enough. There were 110 Falkland Islanders held hostage in a woolshed. They were all released unharmed. And so Chris signalled, radioed to headquarters and said that the battle was over. Brigadier Julian Thompson came in by helicopter, saw what had happened, couldn't believe it, promoted him half-colonel on the spot, awarded him a DSO, gave him command of what was left of Tupara, signalled home for confirmation. And that's where the trouble started. Every para battalion has a godfather general, retired general. General Farah Hockley was Tupara's godfather. He overruled Thompson. He said that Keeble had broken the Paris code of never to negotiate. He was therefore sending out a new commanding officer who hadn't fought, who was put in command over Chris, who then had to go on to Mount Longdon, tumble down, and fight. Chris had to plan it and fight it. And then, of course, afterwards, he came back as a war hero, 10 Downing Street, and then the Paras froze him out. They gave him a territorial battalion. He knew it was the kiss of death. But he took it, and then he just left quietly. But he said that that experience for him showed that it was no good. He had been through hell and back. He had survived unscathed. But he felt that we had to find other ways of resolving these problems. And he has never gone public about this. He has quietly formed his own management training consultancy, and he's now got the government contract for training young civil servants. Can you imagine the impact that man must have on those young people? And I thought this was rather wonderful, and I would recommend that you try to interview him, but I, he'll be probably very annoyed that I've told you, because he wants to play at very low profile. But that, for me, was a very important experience in the Gulf War, to find that a man who'd gone through that and had come out of it like that. And that story has been suppressed, because you're not meant to win battles by negotiating. Okay, where was I? Right, I came out after the Falklands. What happened, in fact, was that they wouldn't release me until they found a relief for me, who, of course, had to be not only briefed on the Soviet threat and the job, but also on the war. And he hadn't even fought in the war, my relief. So I spent about, well, certainly about 6 weeks briefing him. And they finally... Oh, the other thing was, of course, we had to keep up our guard with a full four-watch system for another 2 months after Port Stanley was retaken, because there was a deep fear that a maverick bunch would come and retake it. And we had no airfield there, you see, that was really usable, and no real forces. And it was winter and so on. And so we kept going. And it wasn't until the end of September that they felt that they could relax. And we also had to set up a proper intelligence cell centre down in Port Stanley. And I was very much concerned in helping them do that. And once that was done, they then said I could go. And I had not had time to think about my future career. I hadn't a clue anyway what I wanted to do, and I had no particular qualifications. So the one thing I managed to do was go on a weekend course in a Kensington hotel in about July or August on how to write my CV. And that was actually a very good course, because in order to write the CV, they gave us a little self-analysis, which was a very sensible one for military men. It was sort of list in order of priority from 1 to 10 what you really want in life, and they gave you ideas, you know. And then from that came out that I really wanted to just work with my hands in the open air and be home every night, none of which I had done. And I had no children, and as I was coming out on the redundancy, I was getting a big golden handshake. And I just qualified by 6 months for a pension. I was therefore financially able to indulge myself. And my wife was working. And so I had, in fact, just 3 months terminal leave to begin to think about it. And what I did was I made a list of all the possibilities. And somewhere down around the end was thatching, because that was tea. And I just put it down mechanically without thinking about it. And I went down through all the others and got to tea without having found anything that really I felt I could do. I mean, there's things like building and farming and what have you, but you really had to know what you were doing in all those things. And then I got to thatching. And I suddenly began to think about thatching. And first of all, I tried to find out about it, and it was very difficult to find out anything about it. That intrigued me. Then I looked around me in North Dorset, and I saw a lot of thatch. And I thought, that's interesting. And so I then saw an old man re-thatching a pub in the next door village. And I thought I'd better go and talk to him. He was the first thatcher I'd actually really registered. And he told me he was 79, and he was only thatching part-time now. And he hadn't long gone on his own, because his master had died. And I asked him if he could take me on, and he said, no, he didn't think he could take me on. But he would be able to pass me on to a younger thatcher who might. And I said, have you got enough work? He said, oh, yes. Yes, plenty of work. He was a hereditary thatcher, four generations before him, the classic rustic. Anyway, I went to the younger thatcher, who was in his 50s, And he had only just started going on his own because his master had just died. And he said he was a hereditary Thatcher. He couldn't employ me, because he'd got another boy. But he thought there was an ex-serviceman who was a little while away who might be prepared to see me, because he'd understand me. And he was a good Thatcher as well. That was important. And so I went to see this chap. And his name was Dick Fryer. And he had been in the army for 8 years helping to make maps in the sort of ordnance survey. He'd also been in the Royal Corps of Transport. And he'd come out as a Lance Corporal, I think. And he'd been thatching for 15 years. And he said he'd got a boy, but he wouldn't stop me coming along to the site if I wanted to watch. And so I said I'd like to do that. He never asked me my rank. And so I went on the dole for 6 months and went along. And I was clearing up rubbish for most of the time, but every now and again he would let me do a bit. And I found I liked it. And one of the great things I discovered about thatching was that you're not expected to know anything about it. You can be a complete idiot. That was important for me, because I'm not a do-it-yourself buff or anything like that. Secondly, the tools are very simple. You can almost make them yourself. Thirdly, the raw materials are very simple. And it's very tightly focused. It's not building, really. You're making up the walls a bit. You redo the timbering of the roof. That's good, simple carpentry. You don't have to have any great joinery skills. And it was interesting. Scaffolding. Great fun, scaffolding. Especially old buildings. Especially if you've got aluminium scaffolding. It doesn't kill you in terms of the weight. And that was a problem I was concerned about because I was not very strong. But I was athletically fit. That you do need. You need a head for heights. I'd been quite a keen rock climber when I was young. I found that all tied in well. And then, of course, I loved the countryside. I loved the old buildings. And you were improvising all the time. You were renovating old buildings, which were very interesting. If ever we had to thatch housing estates, I would never have done it. And the people who own the houses are always interesting. They have to have an extra commitment to the house. There's a sort of spiritual thing about it. Because it has to be renewed every generation. It's very expensive, too. The luxury roofing material. And it also gave you instant feedback. You could step back after a day and see exactly what you had done. Whereas a lot of these other things, like pottery and things like this, are terrible. And my wife was a potter. Going through three processes and then it cracks, you know, I mean, I just couldn't do it. And one way or another, I really found that I enjoyed it. And after 6 months, we had a talk. And I said, I want to have a go at this. And so he said he would pay me £1 a week more than the dole. I think it was £27 a week. And I had a pension, of course, coming through, and so I couldn't really complain. And I was taken on as number three. Now, the boy, who was 19, thought he could make a million out of thatching and was wild. And he kept on breaking windows and dropping a tin of nails through the roof. If you could see a full tin of nails and go down through about three ceilings. And he would step on the flowers and things like this. And finally, Dick lost his patience and sacked him. That was my break. That was the equivalent of becoming senior observer of Ark Royal's seeking squadron in one hole. Because I then became the boy, and he was never going to have another boy. And we were only about 2 or 3 years apart in age. And by that time, we got to know each other very well, and we got on. And the way he found out my rank was he moved houses, and he wanted me to witness the conveyance. And I had to put down my occupation. And I looked at him and said, you're not going to let me put down Thatcher, are you? And he said, no. Put down what you were. And I just wrote, Commander RN, retired, you see. Didn't say a word. And we got on fine. And he's not a rustic Thatcher. He was the adopted son of a bank manager, actually. Very chameleon type. And lovely family. My wife got on very well with him as well. And incidentally, my wife was wonderful through all this. She's just so enthusiastic and loyal. She's not at all the typical naval wife. She could handle this. No trouble. And Dick took the telegraph, which was quite unusual for a man working in the building trade. I took the Guardian, and we used to debate on the roof. He also didn't need Radio 1 all the time on the building site, so to speak. So we often used to thatch in silence, quite happily. And I really found that that was to my liking. And my first real high moment was during the 1983 election. Dick was a Thatcherite, ho-ho, and he was complaining about Mrs. Thatcher not supporting small businesses. And so I said, why don't you write a letter to the Telegraph about it? And he said he couldn't be bothered, so I wrote it for him, having done the staff course, you see, and having been secretary to an admiral. And I, of course, started it writing as one Thatcher to another. And they couldn't resist it. They printed it. And anyway, this is the way we got on. And it was very stimulating. Because one of the things that I always have been accused of by my former colleagues was, how on earth could you go and work on a roof and not use your brain anymore? And I actually had to tell them I was often using my brain a lot more than I ever used in the Navy. They were rather hurt to hear that. And it is this business of improvisation. No bundle of reed is the same. This is not an artificial material, this is natural. You had to keep thinking all the time, adjusting, because you were dealing with an old roof and there's no straight lines, nothing. And so you had to keep your wits about you. And then there was all this other aspect on top. And I really took to it. And I had 8 idyllic years of it before the Gulf War forced me, effectively, to stop. So that, if you like, is the background to that.
Yes. Could I go back to the Falklands?
Right.
A little. There are one or two things I'd like to take up with you. You know, when you were talking about the mishandling of the Belgrano, because generally, from what you've said, you really understand the necessity, perhaps, that you know, of sinking the Belgrano. Am I right in thinking that?
I can see how it happened. And it had some decisive effects in terms of the conduct of the war, pro and con. It escalated the war, but it stopped the Navy emerging, the Argentine Navy emerging again, although we didn't know it at the time, and we still had to put in an enormous effort. So I think it will never be fully resolved as to whether or not it was the right thing to do. But of course, in terms of the whole business of the controversy that erupted for the government, I feel that it was extremely risky. That's extremely risky thing to have done. But I don't believe that it was a military decision. It was a political decision, and the military were obeying the politicians. And I always tend to get a little bit riled against people who attack the military for this. They were doing their duty.
Would you have good evidence, you know, for thinking thus?
No, is the answer. Lost in the fog of war. But as I say, I think just about everything that could come out about that has come out. And I would not like to, you know, try and churn it up anymore. As Admiral Fieldhouse said to me, let sleeping dogs lie.
But you were saying how it was mishandled by the government, you know, and this was part of the problem. So far as you're concerned and what you were aware of, were there, you know, cover-ups and lies about any other issues in the Falklands War, so far as you know?
I've mentioned Goose Green. Not that I know of. I mean, obviously there was the problem of nuclear weapons being out there and having to recover them from the wrecks. I don't know any more details about that. The fact they were taken down there, though, I think was a terrible error, and there was a certain degree, I think, of there being such a rush that they almost just forgot to get them off. And I think in some cases they were taken off, but I don't know the details of that. Other things, I'd have to sort of begin to really search back in my memory about any particular incidents, but I think generally it was no worse than any other war. I'd probably just leave it at that.
How about the news coverage of that war?
Well, of course, it was heavily controlled, and that I think is not new. I just think it came out much more, because with modern media and television capability, they were on the spot, and there was a very distinct fear that we could lose, and it was such a close-run thing, and therefore there was paranoia about anything slipping out in terms of positions of ships or state of, you know, battle. And I think that it was very easy to criticise with hindsight.
And going back to the role of the United States, how important was the United States for supplying, you know, for supplies and fuel, would you say?
I'm not sure about that in terms of, I wasn't involved in the logistics very much, but obviously it was very important in terms of general backup for spares, for American-derived weapon systems. Intelligence support I've already covered. There was certain talk about providing backup ships if we had lost an aircraft carrier, but I don't believe that that was ever very realistic. And other than that, I think probably the signals were a bit mixed. Obviously, the intelligence support, as I say, was crucial. I think otherwise there was certain ambivalence going on, as I recall, in the United Nations and things, about how far they were going to go in terms of really supporting us if we got into a spot. So I was really just eyes down in the intelligence business, and I didn't see much of that at all.
Did you have any role in the Franks report? You know, were you called upon
to
give evidence?
It all happened after I left the Navy and they didn't call me. But obviously I read it with great interest, and I noted the whitewash that had been produced about the run-up to the war, and particularly endurance. That was definitely suppressed, because, of course, it was clearly embarrassing to Mrs. Thatcher. And, of course, the whole business of being no contingency plan never came out. Yes, there's one other thing I'd like to mention about the thatching. I found there were quite a lot of ex-servicemen who were thatching. And it made me think. And I think there was an attraction related to the complete antithesis that thatching represented to a service life. In the armed forces, you are very heavily cosseted and almost smothered. And then you suddenly have this total freedom in thatching, which you are having to look after your own business. You've got this, literally, you're out in the open air, you're dealing with natural materials, I sense that there is something quite deep going on there. The other very attractive aspect of thatching was that I was surprised to find there was no closed shop. I expected the rustics to sort of have made it a closed shop. Not at all. People were openly welcomed on merit, and there was something very healthy about that. And there are very few thatchers. I think there are probably about less than 1,000 when I joined. It sort of fluctuated. It was in decline when I was joining, and then it revived. It was all to do with the property boom and unemployment, and young chaps were no longer turning their noses up at thatching. But there were a lot of people in second careers who were coming in like myself. And I actually felt that it was an ideal second career, because it is fairly sedentary. You need to have seen the world a bit before you go into it, and then you don't get frustrated. Because a lot of the youngsters were frustrated. They wanted to go and see the bright lights and and so on. And so I do recommend it to an ex-serviceman.